I think we're on BBS. This is Winfrey, and welcome to our Monday night conference call. Now, I don't know why I call it a conference. I guess I call it a conference call because I'm not sure what to call it. If anyone has a good idea, send it in, because a conference call really doesn't say what we do here. But in certain ways, maybe it's better not to say what we do. Do you hear all that noise? That's background noise on the conference call, which you're all listening in on. So who just came in? Would you like to say your name and your city? Is that one of the great anonymous ones? We welcome anonymity. You know what? For years, whenever I would go to a public event, I would always sit right near the back door because I wanted to be able to leave that event without, if I didn't like it. And that's free will in action. So I know if somebody's checking in and they're anonymous, it's kind of like being in the back door, and it's okay. Leave if you want, stay if you want, but it happens. This is Lynn. I'd like to say your name and your city.
Hi, Wynn. It's Jackie in San Diego.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
It's always so nice to hear your voice.
Thanks.
I always feel so together as soon as you come on. You're so grounded. Yeah. And who else is on there? Anyone else? I know there's someone else. This is Lynn. Would you like to say your name and your city?
Anna, Berkeley, California.
Anna.
Lynn.
So we're putting everyone in BBS into listening to all of you guys check in. So, hi, BBS listeners. We'll be on with the show in a few minutes. Just let things build. Terry's not on yet, is she? She said she was going to come on. I'm sure she'll be on. So let's see how many people we have listening in the background.
There are 6 participants in the conference.
Not very many. 6 people. Only one, though, has been identified. Okay. Let's see. Maybe everybody hates me this week. You know, it's interesting how when you do nothing week after week after week, some people get bored and some people get intrigued and some people get enamored. Now, people who are listening, they want something. Why would they be listening? What do people want when they listen? Well, they probably want to be entertained. They want to be distracted. And some people who are listening, who listen for a long time, know that that's not the principal focus of this show, to entertain you. Although it can be entertaining, it's not the principal focus. Because we're working with something on this show. And in fact, all the things we do, we're working with not an idea. We're working with an energy. We're working with an energy that if you check it out enough, you might feel the energy. And it's not my energy. It's an energy that comes in from other dimensions. It's an intelligence that's in other dimensions. It's paying attention to our show that actually wants to connect with people down here. Now, why would you want to connect with an energy in other dimensions? Well, for one thing, it's safer. They don't want anything except to connect with you and to support you and to actually share love with you. You can actually feel that. Those people that are on the line have had that experience. Who just came in on the line?
Hi, it's Marianne in Chula Vista.
Hi, Marianne.
Hello.
It's Terry on the line.
Jo, Mammoth Falls.
Mary Jo. Hi.
Hi, Wynn.
Hi, Mary Jo.
Hello, Wynn.
You see, when different people come in on the line, they each bring their energy with them. And those of you that are sensitive can actually feel the energy, not the personality, but the energy. Like Jackie is really grounded. So when she comes on, it's like suddenly there's a rock underneath me. Mary Jo is like a river. She flows. Mary Ann is kind of like a river, too. There's a flowing energy. Anna, what's your energy like? If you wanted to describe your energy. Anna, did you disappear?
Myself. I feel like, I don't know, I feel very energetic.
Energetic.
Actually,
I think you're
very
like...
very advanced with life. I really do. I feel like it's magical.
You know, I think if I was going to describe your energy, it's almost like an astrological thing. It's like fire, okay?
Hmm.
You have fire, enthusiasm, fire.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie has groundedness. And Mary Jo and Mary Ann have flowingness like water. If we had an astrologist here, they'd probably say, oh, that's what predominates in your chart. Who just came on? Let's say your name and your city.
Hi, this is Terry.
Oh, we've been waiting for you.
Okay.
Now, what's Terry's energy like? Mary Jo, what do you think?
Hi.
You can't answer yourself, Terry. Somebody else.
Oh, all right.
Mary Jo, what do you think Terry's energy is?
Terry's is like a song.
Like a song?
Terry's is like a song. Yes, very much so.
That's nice. I like that.
It is. It truly is. You have, you are a song.
Sweet and
gentle. She is like a song, isn't she?
A beautiful song.
She thinks in her last life she was a famous singer.
Really?
Yeah.
I danced for the London Ballet, and I sang, but I wasn't really famous because I didn't get real famous as a singer, but I did sing.
Yes.
She just did all that stuff so she could get a rich husband.
No. My last life, I was very rich.
You were?
I didn't get a rich husband. I got a poor husband.
I see. You supported your poor husband. Now, Terry remembers some of her past lives. And, God. Somebody that's listening to us for the first time is saying, who the hell are these guys? maybe no one's listening for the first time. This is a group of a bunch of vagabond independent spirits.
Wanderers.
Pardon me?
Wanderers.
Wanderers that I think they all have something in common together, and probably some of you that are listening have the same thing in common, but you never even heard it said. One of the unique things about our group is that we've had all of these communications with other realms, with intelligences in other realms. And so there's an indication that we've got a perspective on life and what's happening on our planet in a way that's somewhat rare, because it's not that ordinary for people to have these kinds of ongoing communications with other realms. And I think one aspect of the communications and the nature of it is that it's not where they lecture me or you or anyone, usually. Well, sometimes they might, but usually it's all been in dialogues, so I'm always asking them questions. And I tend to be very skeptical, and I don't believe things easily. And if some voice was talking to me and said, I am from another realm and here is the truth, I would probably run the other direction. Because I would say, how do I know that's true? And the extraordinary thing about the communications that we've been getting is that it's happened in such a way that there's an unusual ability to cross-reference information and say, well, this person said that, and then this person said that, and then I'm talking about people who are channeling, and this person said that, and independently asking them questions, they're all saying the same thing. And then that accompanies kind of phenomena that we've all experienced, that physical phenomena that validates the information and the communications. Somebody else just came on. Just your name and your city. Okay. Wayne. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Wayne.
And somebody else just came on. Would you?
John in New Jersey.
John. Hey, John.
How you doing?
Nice to hear you. What city in New Jersey are you?
Red Bank.
Red Bank. Where is that?
It's near Sandy Hook. It's right on the coast, right below New York City.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I used to live in New York City. At least for about 6 months. You know, I was talking about astrology, and I'll share something with you all that I don't think I've ever shared. And it was probably one of the things that I experienced that has caused me to be doing, or led me to do what I'm doing now. And I grew up in Philadelphia, and I was kind of a nerdy guy, and I was a ham radio operator when I was in high school, and I used to go home from school every day and get on my ham radio stuff. We lived in a little row house in Philadelphia, and we had all these big antennas on the roof, and I would just go home and get really excited about getting on the air and talking to people in Russia and in China and all over the world. And I said, man, what could be more far out than that? Well, God, learning how to talk to people all over the universe and not even have any equipment. But in any case, I went to college, and I thought I wanted to be a physics major because I had an aptitude for electronics and wanting to learn how things worked. And then I used to come home from college I went to school in Berkeley, and I went back to Philadelphia, and I worked at television stations. And in those days, things were not automated, and everything had to be done manually. So there was a director, and you had to push buttons and say, okay, now we're going to run the commercial, and you would watch for the blip, and then you would punch it in. and it was very precise. And it was a very good job, and people never understood why I didn't make a career of it, because I thought I was in the electricians union, and I don't know how that was. I think I was making $600 a week 25 years ago, which was an enormous amount of money at that time. And so, hey, this is Wayne. Would you like to say your name and your city? Okay. So I had...
Hi, Wayne. This is Maya.
Hey, Maya.
Is it the radio show still?
Yeah, you're talking on the air right now.
You are talking on what?
You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I'm you then.
No, you're in Hawaii, right? Are you in, you're in Hawaii. That's Maya in Hawaii. So, this is a different kind of opening for this show. I guess it's always different, so I'll just go with the flow. There I was, going back and working at radio and TV stations as what they called summer relief. And I had my first experience of synchronicity. And something happened to me that I spent probably years having in the back of my mind. And even when I tell you this, I still am not sure my explanation is correct. But I'll share what it was. I was working in a radio station. It was WHYY. And I was playing music for, it was an educational station. And I was playing in Gilbert and Sullivan opera. And in those days, it was a turntable. There was turntable one, turntable two. And there were four sides of this record. And I started it out on turntable one. And then I went to turntable two. And I was very, very casual. I remember I would have my feet up on the desk. And I would call people up, and I'd say, tune it in, and I would turn the volume up, and it would go louder in their home, and I said, by God, what power I have. And I wasn't paying really close attention to what I was doing. And so I played side one, and then I went to side two, and somebody called up and said that it was out of order. And I looked at the record, and I said, oh, my God, I blew it. I'm playing side three instead of side two. And so when you made a mistake like that, you had to write up a report of every mistake. And it was total negligence on my part that I did that. And so I got really chewed out. I mean, close to losing my job for being so negligent. So the following week, there was another Gilbert and Sullivan opera. And again, there were four sides, side one and side two. And this time, I kept looking at side two. And I go back to side one, and it said, you know, the label said side one. Then I looked at the other record, and it said side two. And I kept looking at side two. And the thought in my mind was, if I turn my back, it was going to flip. I remember very distinctly having a really powerful thought that if I turn my back on that record, it would flip over, and I would make the same mistake, and I would lose my job. And so there was no way it could do that, of course, but that was the thought in my mind. So I played side one, and then I played side two, and the same guy called and said, they're out of order. And I looked at the label, and it said, side two. And I said, no, it's side two. And he said, no, get the script out. And there was a script, so I got the script out. And sure enough, the label said side two, but I was playing side three. So in my entire life, I have never experienced anyone that has ever had a record where the label was wrong, okay? And I said, in my thought of thinking that the record was going to flip over, did I rearrange it? Or did the higher forces come in and do that to start triggering me into the idea that it was possible to do something like that? I thought about it for months because it seemed like so impossible. And of course, I didn't lose my job because I went in to the chief engineer and I said, look, I didn't do it. And I mean, he couldn't believe it himself. But the first week I was negligent and the second week the labels were reversed. And so eventually, this is why I got started on this track because John said New York and I was thinking about New York City. At that time, I was getting really bored with school, and I started playing music. And I started writing songs, and I went through all these phases. I had a rock and roll band, and then I had my first college girlfriend, Jillian, who was my cheering section for my songs that I was writing, because I never took myself seriously as a songwriter. And she was in my rock and roll band. And then Jillian and I had a Volkswagen bus, and we traveled around the country as a duo. And we were like hippie emissaries. I had really long hair, and we just, like, at that time, if you came from the Bay Area and you had long hair, you were this phenomena that everyone had ever was reading about in the newspaper. And they say, oh, my God, we got real live ones in town. So we would go into bars, and the bands would step aside, and we would go sing and pass the hat, and we would make enough money to go to the next town. And we probably did this for about a year and a half or 2 years, and it was just an extraordinary experience. And then at a certain point, I felt codependent on Jillian, and I felt like I needed to experience life myself. And so we didn't really break up. I just said, I'm going to start hitchhiking. And we lived in Berkeley, and I packed a knapsack, I took my guitar, and I had learned how to do astrology charts. And Jillian was an astrologer, and actually, someday I'll have her on here. We're still friends. I was like this logical physics major, and she was doing astrology, and I thought there was no way astrology could work. And I started to know all of our friends and their signs. And occasionally, I was able to guess someone's sign. And I didn't even believe in astrology, but I guessed their sign because they reminded me of someone else that had the same sign. And I started to become sensitive to the energies of signs. And then I started doing astrology charts because I said, hey, there's something to this. And I did everybody's chart. I probably did 200 or 300 charts. And I decided I was going to just put a bunch of astrology books in my backpack, start traveling, and I was going to do people's charts everywhere in exchange for staying in the living rooms, and playing music. And that trip probably lasted 4 years, and it profoundly changed my life. Because I remember thinking when I first started that trip, it was a little scary. I was so vulnerable. I was by myself, and I'm throwing myself out into the world. And I remember saying to myself, if there's a God, then I want a demonstration on this trip. And probably took about 2 days. And after 2 days, everything became synchronicities. I would do astrology charts, and I was seeing something that was just blowing me out, because every day there would be cycles that were astrological cycles, where, for example, if somebody picked me up when I was hitchhiking, and I would sit in the back of the car, and it'd be a couple. Maybe the guy was a Taurus and the woman was a Gemini. I think I'll mute everybody. Hang on.
All callers are muted.
Well, they would drop me off, and then somebody else would pick me up, and they would have exactly the same astrological configuration. The guy would be a Taurus and the woman would be a Gemini. And it was not perfect, but it was really statistically impossible how often that happened to me. And then it would change from day to day. So one day it would be Taurus Gemini, the next day it might be Aries and Scorpio. And I said, how can this work? How can this work? And I drew the conclusion that there was something in my vibration that was changing every day that attracted different kinds of people to me, and it would be very, very predictable. And then when I got to New York City, and I may have gotten there, I think what I did when I got to New York City is I went to a cafe, and I sung some of my songs at an open mic, and there were these two guys who were in college, and they took me home, and I stayed in their living room, and I was kind of like a hero. This was kind of like a hero's journey. My God, this guy came from nowhere, and he's playing these great songs, and we want to get to know him. And so I was living in the East Village, and I would go out in the East Village and sit on a stoop, and I'd have my astrology books, and people would line up, and I would just give these quickie readings. And I remember that I was getting the sensitivity to a certain birthday, May 28th. It really connected to my chart in a way. What I learned was I could feel the energies of people, and I could feel how their energies would connect with my chart. And so it would stimulate a certain energy in my body or in my field. And when I could felt that really strongly, and I said, I think you're this sign, then quite often I was right. And there was a particular birthday, it was May 28th, that was a Gemini, that connected with my Venus. And this woman came by the step I was sitting on, and she said she was May 28th. And about a half an hour later, somebody just walked by, and I just stopped them, and I said, excuse me, your birthday's not May 28th, is it? And they were May 28th. And the next day, I was walking through a busy New York street. I remember there was a jazz pianist named Burton Green that I was friends with. We were walking together somewhere in the village, and a woman walked by with her mother, and I just said, excuse me, are you a Gemini? And she said, yes. How do you know? And I said, you're not May 28th, are you? And she said, oh, my God. And her mother pulled her off like she had just seen the devil, because it was scary that a stranger said that to her. But I was getting this firsthand experience of being in a flow. And my nerdy scientific physics side just didn't know what to make of this. And just was observing and trying to figure out how this is supposed to work in the world. And eventually, I got to be a good enough songwriter. And part of my goal in writing songs was to try to convey this alternative reality that I started to live in. I started to see that there were all these flows of energy on top of the physical world. And when I let myself go and just hitchhiked and say, okay, I'm open, I would get into those flows of energy and things would happen that couldn't normally happen by the regular rules of the world. And I was trying to write songs about that. I wanted to say, hey, there's this whole overlay reality of energy that most people don't even know exists. They're not aware of it. And they're all trying to make things happen in a linear way. And I guess I was experiencing non-linearity. The thing about it was that I could only experience it when I was hitchhiking, when I was just, like, totally anonymous. As soon as I stopped and tried to live somewhere, I would lose it. It would go away, and I would be drawn into mundane things. So I got the idea that I was good enough at all of this to become a successful songwriter, and I wanted to do that. And just prior to going to Los Angeles, I ended up, this is a funny story, I ended up walking into a discotheque, they called them discotheques in those days, in Greenwood Lake, New Jersey, and it was owned by a mafioso guy by the name of Tommy Granatoli, and he listened to a couple of my songs and said, well, you're pretty good, but no one's going to listen to you because you're too quiet. And I think my songs were kind of James Taylor-ish at that time. I would have identified myself as writing that kind of sensitive material. But he said, I'll tell you what, how much do you charge? And I was also playing music at some colleges. I was playing music at some coffee shops. And I said, $25. He said, oh, I'll put you on tonight in between the bands. And I think he felt sorry for me. And so I went up. And I started performing my regular songs, and nobody was listening. This was a discotheque that the drinking age in New York was 18, and the drinking age in New Jersey was 21. So it was just jammed with kids driving up from New Jersey getting drunk. And I was, like, invisible on the stage. So I looked at the crowd, and something inside me said, I am not going to fail. I'm going to reach these people. And I said, okay, I'm going to do a primal scream. And I screamed at the top of my lungs, and I had the attention of everyone in the room. Everyone looked at me. So I said, what do I do now? So I said, okay, you guys scream. And they all screamed back at me. So for the next 10 minutes, we were screaming at the top of our lungs to each other. I walked off the stage, and the owner said, okay, you're hired for the summer. And I started to write songs. I said, I've got to write songs to reach these people.
All callers are unmuted.
And I started to write a whole different kind of song. I started to learn how to do blues. I wrote a song called Do It Till You're Sick of It. Maybe some of you heard that. And I was sleeping. Where was I staying? The house band was called Everyone, and I was sleeping in a tent behind their house, which was across the street from the discotheque. And eventually, I had all these top 40 bands jamming with me, and that was like probably prior to the Grateful Dead even. And, the bands were very rigid in their sets, and my sets became really, really popular, because they just became these loose jams. And the manager of that band, Everyone, was a guy by the name of Mark Gillotin. And Mark loved my music. And I said, you know what? I'm a good enough songwriter to be successful. So my next stop was to go to Los Angeles, and I ended up running into Mark Gillotin, who had come to Los Angeles also. He was working for a music publisher, and he got some of my songs recorded through that publisher. It was a guy by the name of Don Costa. Hey, this is Wynn. You want to say hello? Who just
Marilyn.
Came? Who is that?
Marilyn.
Hi,
Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn. We're having a very heavy discussion about my early life and synchronicities. So, good to have you.
All callers are muted.
Somehow I'm going to have to tie this into the Elohim and Ra. I'm trying to figure that out. Hope will give me some help. So I had some songs recorded, and then Mark ended up getting a job for a very famous songwriter by the name of Brian Holland, who was Holland Dozier Holland, who wrote all the songs for the Supremes. And he kept telling me, come over to their office. And I went over to their office, and Mark had lost his job by the time I got there. But I left a tape on the desk, and I ended up going to a restaurant a couple blocks away, and I'm talking to this guy next to me, telling him how I was hitchhiking around the country, and I come to Los Angeles because I wanted to be successful as a songwriter. And he ends up saying, I write a few songs. And I said, ever been recorded? And he said, oh, my name's Brian Holland. And it was the very guy sitting next at the coffee bar, you know, at the bar of the restaurant. And he said, I'm going to have to listen to your songs. Well, without telling the whole story, they ended up loving my songs. We wrote some songs together. And then I had the synchronicity of synchronicities, probably the most amazing one in my life. And that is, I would used to go down to Venice Beach every day and take a walk on the beach. And one day, I went into a bar called the Sunset Saloon. And I never go into bars. I never drink. But it was a very hot day, and I decided I'm going to get a beer. I'm sitting at the bar, and there's this woman next to me by the name of Pat, and she's getting drunk, and she's really liking me. And the only time in my life ever I went home with a woman at a bar, and I started seeing her. And she lived about a block, two blocks from the beach. And a month later, she moved into a very exclusive apartment complex in Marina Del Rey, and probably with about 600 apartments in three buildings. And so I started seeing her in her new apartment. And about a month later, I left her house, or left her apartment, and I walked by the door. It was next door to her apartment, and there was an envelope pasted on the door, and I just glanced at it, and it was addressed to Brian Holland, the very guy who I was building a relationship with in the music business. So, what are the chances of that? To meet a woman in a bar who moves into a complex next door to Brian Holland in the city of L.A. with 10 million people. So those guys ended up giving me the key to their office, giving me their stationery. They said, Wynn, they recognized that whatever was bringing us together was more than my ambition to be a successful songwriter. And now how did that get screwed up? Because I didn't become a I had some songs recorded, but I didn't become a successful songwriter. This is a very interesting story, and this is going to bring us into present time. And it's also going to share with you a little bit about the crazy way the universe works to cause something to happen just beyond anything you could dream of. There was a gentleman by the name of Michael who we had written some songs together. And Michael suggested that we send one of the songs we wrote together to this publishing house in Nashville. And so up to that point, I was sending all my songs out on the Holland Brothers stationery. And I felt very protected because they're so big that I think I said this, they wrote all the songs for the Supremes and the Four Tops, the three black guys that actually started Motown. Barry Gordy started it, but they produced and discovered and produced Diana Ross, which was Motown's first entry into the world. So we sent this song to this publisher in Nashville, and 6 months later, people were calling me up, congratulating me on my hit song. And I bought the record because I didn't know about it, and I saw that one of the songs we put on that tape was sent to that publisher in Nashville, and the song that was this hit was a rewritten version of my song published by that publisher. And I went into shock. It was as if, up to that point, I was floating on air. Everything was synchronicities, everything was magic. And I said, it's only going to be a short while that I'm going to be world famous. And suddenly, I was scared to play songs. I withdrew. My life fell apart. And I ended up, I'm not going to tell you all the stories, but I ended up selling sunglasses at street fairs for the next 20 years. And another, I have to bring up another little thing about Michael Horn. I had a teacher at that time, a spiritual teacher, and I used to go to his seminars, and sitting in his seminars was the very first time I had ever experienced light energy come into a room. When he would talk, there was this energy that would happen. Didn't matter what he was saying. Something would transform in the whole room. And at the end of the seminar, or the end of the talk, everyone was hugging each other. Everyone was loving each other. And I learned a lot from that guy. His name is John Roger. In fact, he still has an organization. And one of the things that happened was that he had a scandal. And he was having, I shouldn't say his name, because I don't mean to bring up the scandal and say his name because I think he's past that. But he had a scandal where he was sleeping with some of his disciples. And it became, a lot of the people in his group broke away from his group. And this guy, Michael, was somebody that I introduced to his teachings. And Michael got really mad at me and really kind of self-righteous about the fact that this guy was doing this. And this is a very important little point in the story to share. Because here I am 20 years later, and I'm selling sunglasses, and I'm in San Diego, and I'm saying, I am totally off track. I'm a creative guy. I wrote great songs. And it was after one of these fairs, and I bought a little notepad, and I started writing poems. And I realized I could still write. And I started sending poems out over the internet to different New Age publications and people that posted poems. And so my poems were getting posted. And this one publication said, we don't do poems, but would you consider writing on assignment? And so I said, sure. Now, I had never, ever written on assignment. I had never written prose. I only wrote songs and poems. And I don't know why they asked me to do that, but they did, and I said yes. And I interviewed a famous author, and they loved my interview, and they said, we'd like you to write every month an article, and we're going to pay you to do it. So here I am working for this publication. In fact, if you go on the internet, you can still see some of those articles. Look up Spirit of Mott, M-A-A-T. And it's it was a web magazine that was published. The guy at the very top was Grimoire Melchizedek, who I never met. I just wrote for his magazine. And some of you may know him because he teaches something called, what is it called? I forget. But he has his Flower of Life, Merkaba circulation. So I was interviewing people. Now, let's go back to Michael Horn. Michael Horn was the guy who, A, caused my song to get stolen, become a big hit, caused me to drop out of the music business, and was mad at me for introducing him to a guru that was sleeping with his disciples. And so I get an email from Michael, and we maintained a loose connection, but I was always nervous about being around him because he didn't do anything wrong, but he stimulated such a huge fall in my life that I didn't want to be around him. Just some subconscious fear. I'm sure it was some karmic thing that happened. I get an email from him, and he's sending me an article that was on an alternative website called Rents. And the email has the story of Sai Baba sleeping with his male disciples. And if you don't know who Sai Baba is, he was an Indian, he is, he's still alive, an Indian guru that some Indians think he's God. He would manifest things in his hands, he could do magical things, and he seems to have a lot of charitable organizations all over India. And suddenly Michael sends me this story of Sai Baba sleeping with his disciples because he's trying to make the case that you can't trust gurus because they're all sleeping with their disciples. And I read the story and I said, I wonder who wrote this story.
And all callers are unmuted.
There was a link to the author. And I went through that link. I ended up on David Wilcock's website. David Wilcock wrote that expose on Sai Baba. So where this all comes around is that here Michael Horn took me out of what I thought was my life purpose when I was younger, which was playing music. I spun around for 20 years, twiddling my thumbs, and then the same guy puts me back into writing the book, The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce, who I interviewed for that Spirit of Mott magazine, which led to writing the book. And if I didn't write the book, nothing else would have happened. I would have never met Daphne. I would have never experienced my personal challenge. I don't think so. Maybe I would have, but... So if it wasn't for gay sex between gurus, we wouldn't be here now. And this is the way this crazy universe works. And you never know it's what domino you're going to push that's going to start a chain reaction. Now, I have to assume that when I was experiencing all those synchronicities, that I was kind of being looked at and watched, and these guys were waiting for some kind of opportunity, but they couldn't figure out how to do it, of making this known to me that this was a possibility of something that was going to happen in my life, this kind of communication. But it's not easy to get that door open. And if it wasn't for Edgar Cayce and the connection between David Wilcock and Edgar Cayce, I don't think I would have ever opened the door because I didn't trust channeling. In fact, I knew Terry. I knew Terry for 20 years. I met Terry after after everything fell apart for me. And I decided I needed to make a lot of money, and I was doing I thought, well, I'll just make a lot of money in multi-level marketing and go back to music. And when I met Terry, we didn't make a lot of money, but we became the best of friends. And so she watched me go through all this sunglass selling, and in fact, we used to go out together and sell sunglasses, right? And then we had another guy with us, and he would go out. So it's kind of a wild story. And I think where the story really becomes important is that this whole thing has led to a bigger story that has so much evidence that it's real. You know, so many people want to know that there's forces out there that love them, that want to help them. And so few people have such a totally congruent story proving that it's true, proving that there really are energies in other realms that are intelligent and conscious that are there for the asking if you can tune into their frequency. And really, the purpose of this conference call, in fact, the purpose of everything we do, I guess it's really two purposes. Maybe I'll think of three by the time I say the two, but one of them is to help people develop personal relationships with these forces that we've come to know as the Elohim and Ra, to know that they are as real as your husband, your children, and you can know it because you hear my stories and you know that I couldn't make them up and that these things really happened, and how do you explain them? And the other way you can know it is by checking into these conference calls and tuning into their frequencies, because they are on these calls. They are in between my words. They are in your space. We're not dealing with an intelligence in the way you would normally think of intelligence. We're talking in terms of group souls that have millions and billions of individual souls spread through the universe that are the major first archetypes. I believe this is true. I can't prove this, but it seems true that they're the first archetypical form of creation. And here they are paying attention to us, and that we've opened up a portal to those energies that is allowing us to have a direct experience of their energies, plus verbal messages where we can have the experience of their energies and they can talk to us. You know, I am sure when I sat in that fellow that I mentioned, that guru, and I could feel all those energies drop into the room, he was working with their energies, and he was very masterful. And I don't know how he explained it to himself. I don't know if he thought of group souls or anything like that, but he certainly knew how to bring those energies into the room, and it would always be there. And it's like once you learn to receive it, you can also learn to give it, which means for a while you're going to be on the receiving end. Well, maybe some of you have had that experience, and now it's just defining it in a more succinct way for your logical mind and making it more maneuverable. I know in the past when I felt those energies in the room, and I felt them with that guy, and I felt them with a couple other people eventually, when they would give a talk, it never occurred to me that that energy was intelligent, that there was something way up there that was consciously projecting that energy into the space. Never occurred to me, but I could feel the energy. Now I know that that energy is intelligent, and because we're talking to it, it's we're having a rapport with that energy in these two group souls. And, of course, between the combination of the book on David Wilcock and Edgar Cayce and, 6:53. Well, Terry said she was tired and she didn't want to channel. Are you there, Terry?
I'm here, yes.
By the way, if you missed last week's show, we had one of the best channelings on grace and how that works. And they were explaining that there was a high section of the Elohim that could project into this realm and lubricate things so that things could flow above the normal human, what did they say, geometries. They use the word geometries because they see everything as we're just, you and I, are just a bunch of structured geometries to them. And if the geometries get rearranged, everything changes. The Rod Loop works on the personal challenges we need to overcome in ourselves so that we can rearrange the geometries. Because one of the things that holds that back is our own rigidity in our own field that prevents us from tapping in to the higher levels of grace. And I'm sure when I was hitchhiking around the country and I went to Los Angeles and I had all those miraculous things happen, I was experiencing grace in a big, big way because I had let go of all my geometry, so to speak. In letting go and hitchhiking, there was nothing rigid in my space, and I opened up to the flow of the universe. Now the challenge is, and I think we're learning to do that, is to stay in one place and do the same thing and create those synchronicities from a center point rather than being on the circumference. So it is now 6:55. We're probably off BBS already. Well, okay. Is anyone listening? Are we off BBS? Well, if we're not off, we should be. So I'll say goodbye to everyone on BBS. And on that note, for those of us that are on the call,